Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, and offer only available until July 15th.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 1st of June, these are our main stories. European leaders meeting in Moldova have vowed to remain united in the face of Russian aggression. The US House of Representatives overwhelmingly passes a debt bill just days before the world's biggest economy is due to start defaulting on repayments. An Australian soldier who's been recognised with military honours has lost a defamation case against newspapers who accused him of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Also in this podcast, why China's university graduates are worried about their job prospects, NASA hosts its first public meeting on UFOs, and whetting your appetite, an Israeli company creates 3D fish fillets in a lab.
We are doing the real deal. We are collecting real cells. We proliferate them. And the end result is a product that is, at this point, almost exactly the same as the fish.
Scores of European leaders have gathered in Moldova for a summit focusing on the continent's security. It comes with the war in Ukraine already having lasted 15 months, and it's being held just a few kilometres from the Russian-controlled separatist enclave of Transnistria. Along with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, topics on the agenda include action on climate and energy. For Moldova itself, the stakes are high. It declared independence from the Soviet Union in 1991 and hopes to join the European Union by 2030. But Ukraine was the main focus in the opening remarks of the President of Moldova, Maia Sandu.
It is a pleasure and an honour to be hosting so many of you here today in Moldova, amidst the serene surroundings of Castelnimi. Its peace and tranquility are a sharp contrast to the violent war that's being fought just off our border, the biggest war on our continent since World War II, a war of choice launched by Russia, a war that brings us all together in our strong desire to restore peace on our continent.
President Volodymyr Zelensky, who's in Chisinau, explained the position of countries like Ukraine.
Every European country that borders Russia and that does not want Russia to tear it apart should be a full member of the EU and NATO. And there are only two alternatives to this, either an open war or creeping Russian occupation. We see what is happening in Belarus. We see what is happening in Georgia. We see how these nations are being dragged, although in different ways, into the same state of lawlessness.
I spoke to our correspondent, Jenny Hill, who's in Moldova.
President Zelensky's presence here, of course, means that this summit will very much focus on the war in his country. He's done the rounds of Europe's capitals in recent weeks, and he's extracted promises of more money, more weapons from various leaders. But what he still really wants are security guarantees. And he has repeated once again today his country's desire to join NATO. He says that Ukraine is ready to join NATO. And it's also very interesting that this summit is being held in Moldova. That's no accident, of course, as you pointed out there. This country, perhaps more than any of Ukraine's neighbours, has real reason to have felt great fear when Vladimir Putin carried out his full-scale invasion because of its past, because of the fact that Russian soldiers are still stationed in the breakaway region of Transnistria, which is controlled by pro-Russian separatists. Now, both Kyiv and Moldova want to join the EU. They both have candidacy status that was granted last year along with Georgia. But certainly the president of Moldova is very keen to get that process moving. She said on the eve of this summit that she wants accession talks to begin this year, if possible. And we know that President Zelensky has a similar aim.
And what else is being discussed? Because it's not just about Ukraine, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, that issue does dominate. The idea of this new grouping, actually, I mean, this only is meeting for the second time, Emmanuel Macron's brainchild of the EU bloc, plus a lot of other European countries, Britain, which has left the EU, of course, a lot of countries which want to join the EU. So each nation brings, of course, its own agenda, its own set of problems. So we're talking about things like climate change, future energy supply, cybersecurity, migration. That's a big one for the British. But two other potential flashpoints are also being discussed here. And you've got the leaders of Azerbaijan and Armenia. It's hoped that their dispute over the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh might be something that they could ease steps towards some kind of peaceful solution there. But of course, we've seen tensions flare in northern Kosovo recently too. You've got the Serbian leader, the Kosovan leader here. Neither have struck particularly conciliatory tones so far, but this is a forum in which some of the other leaders are hoping that progress could be made.
Jenny Hill in Moldova. Russia says the border region of Belgorod has once again come under artillery fire from Ukraine, leaving 9 people injured and buildings damaged. Meanwhile, 3 people were killed in Ukraine during a Russian missile attack on the capital Kyiv. Paul Moss reports.
They're building temporary shelters for those forced to flee from the artillery fire hitting Belgorod, a sign Russia doesn't expect the attacks to stop anytime soon. Russian television has covered this upheaval, suggesting Vladimir Putin wants Russians to feel their country is under attack, a justification for his continuing war on Ukraine. But lest anyone forget where the war is hitting hardest, 3 people were killed by Russian missiles fired at Kyiv overnight. Just a few more casualties in a conflict that's killed thousands of Ukrainian civilians.
Paul Moss. South Africa is under growing pressure to decide whether it'll allow the Russian President Vladimir Putin to visit the country for a summit later this year. A decision is to be made about whether it will honour a commitment to arrest him in accordance with a warrant from the International Criminal Court. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is visiting South Africa today. A correspondent in Cape Town is Andrew Harding.
South Africa is in a tight spot. It has refused to condemn Russia for its invasion of Ukraine and appears keen to welcome President Putin to a summit of the BRICS group, which also includes India, China and Brazil. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has come to Cape Town to lay the groundwork for that August summit. But South Africa is legally obliged to arrest President Putin if he sets foot here and to send him to The Hague to face war crimes charges. If Mr. Putin comes but is not arrested, then South Africa is likely to face severe economic consequences.
Andrew Harding in South Africa. It went to the wire, but after weeks of wrangling, Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives have finally struck a deal to stop the US government from defaulting on its debt. Without an agreement, there were fears of a market panic and a global economic crisis. The bill to suspend the government's debt limit will now go to the US Senate. Our correspondent, Jessica Parker, reports from Capitol Hill.
Yeas are 314, the nays are 117. The bill is passed.
The gavel comes down in the House of Representatives, marking the passing of the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Quite a mouthful to say, and it's been a marathon to get here.
Mr. Speaker, what do you say to your
frantic talks saw the White House trying to defend spending plans, Republicans trying to pare them back. But for some Conservatives, the agreed curbs are nowhere near enough.
I can't tell you how disappointed I am in the way that this went down. It didn't have to go down this way.
In the U.S. Capitol building, I talked to Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who rejected the bill.
If everyone voted the way you're voting, and this bill wasn't passed, and Monday came, and the U.S. couldn't pay the bills that it owes, would that really be a scenario you're okay with?
The default is not on the table. That is a scare tactic by the media and by the left. I'm sure Janet Yellen could find a couple buckets of money to move it around and find a way to extend the time. So thank you so much.
Janet Yellen is the U.S. Treasury Secretary, who said the country could soon run out of money to pay its bills. Cue warnings of an economic catastrophe, unpaid Social Security, wages, job losses, even a global downturn. Fears which echoed in the House chamber.
Republicans claim that they just had to threaten the economic well-being of every American man, woman, and child.
But Democrats aren't exactly thrilled with a deal that tightens up welfare rules.
I don't know if anybody was jumping up and down saying, boy, this is great.
However, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver said it had to pass.
And all this drama surrounding the debt ceiling and this looming deadline and the potential consequences, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Yes. What does that say about U.S. politics?
Well, I think what it says is that we're going through a stinky season. We're looked at in a lesser light than we have in the past, and it's our fault. And I think there are some people who don't care.
I'm in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol building. It's got marble floors, a high ceiling, a chandelier, and if you walk just through an archway here, you come to the entrance of an office that has been central to these talks, that of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. He's been negotiating with the White House, but also with his own Republican Party.
We're never going to get everybody, but we have spent 4 months bringing everybody together. And whether you voted for or voted against it, you wanted something more.
Joe Biden arrives to applause in Colorado Springs, where he's meeting Air Force cadets. He's welcomed the House vote and is now urging the Senate to pass the deal as quickly as possible. According to the U.S. Treasury, they've only got until Monday to do so.
Jessica Parker. He was seen as a national hero in Australia after winning several military honours, including the Victoria Cross. But now Ben Robert Smith has lost a defamation case against three newspapers who accused him of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Instead, a judge found the papers had effectively proved most of the allegations against him. Speaking outside the federal court in Sydney, James Chessel, the managing editor of publishing at the newspaper's owner Nine Entertainment, welcomed the judgment.
The findings by Justice Anthony Bosanco today that Robert Smith participated in the execution of Afghans confirms our reports that the Victoria Cross recipient breached the Geneva Convention and is a critical step towards justice for the families of the murder victims.
Our correspondent Phil Mercer told me more.
Ben Robert Smith is Australia's most decorated living soldier. He sued three newspapers over a series of articles first published in 2018, which he said defamed him. They said that they portrayed him as a callous man who had broken the moral and legal code of war, disgraced his uniform and his country. Now, the media outlets relied on the truth defence. They said that the stories were factually correct and that Mr. Robert Smith was involved in the murders of six unarmed prisoners or civilians in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2012. And this has been a marathon defamation hearing. In its conclusion, the judge in the case, Anthony Bosanco, says that for the most part, the newspapers did prove some of the most serious allegations of war crimes made against Ben Robert Smith.
Now, we've heard some reaction from the newspaper's publisher. What about other reaction, including from Ben Robert Smith himself?
We've not heard from the former SAS corporal himself. One of his lawyers said afterwards that they would be digesting the court's ruling and making a decision about any appeal. It's worth noting, well, two things. Firstly, that the judge's full judgment won't be made public until early next week. So we still don't know many of the specific reasons behind his decision. It's also worth pointing out, too, that this is not a criminal finding of guilt, but a determination of the civil standard of the balance of probabilities. So this wasn't a criminal case. It was a civil case. But of course, in the fullness of time, there may well be ramifications for the Australian military and Ben Robert Smith himself, given that in the past, the Australian military has been accused of other alleged war crimes in Afghanistan.
I mean, Australia must be rocked by this whole issue.
This is an enormous case. Once upon a time, Ben Robert Smith was the most famous soldier in this country. He was awarded the Victoria Cross, which is this country's highest military honour for what was described at the time as an heroic single man assault on the Taliban in Afghanistan that earned Ben Robert Smith the Victoria Cross. But certainly his reputation has been shredded by this marathon defamation case, and the judge essentially saying that for the most part, the newspaper's allegations against him were true. So we're now waiting to hear what Ben Robert Smith does next.
Phil Mercer. For millions of students around the world, it's graduation season. And in China, more than 11 million young people are expected to receive their highly prized certificates in the coming weeks. But there's a problem. There aren't enough jobs which match their qualifications. Figures from April show a record 20% of people aged between 16 to 24 are unemployed. So, what's going on? I asked our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow.
It's complicated, and there are a number of reasons. Firstly, China is only 6 months away from coming out of strict COVID restrictions, which really damaged the economy. So that's only now getting back on track. And that hasn't been quite as good as some of the officials hoped. So there's a lack of jobs generally in the economy, and specifically a lack of jobs for highly educated graduates. Secondly, the government over recent years has done a number of things which has damaged graduates' opportunities. So, for example, a few years ago, it stopped educational institutions making a profit outside education, tutoring groups, that kind of thing. And so that's cut off a lot of opportunities for graduates. And perhaps after 3 decades of stellar economic growth in China, graduates now are expecting better paid, high status jobs, and they're just not prepared to take the jobs which are on offer.
Yeah, they're all expecting the glittering prizes. So what are the authorities doing to try to tackle this problem?
Just today, the province of Henan, which is 100 million people, has launched a 100-day campaign to target graduates, essentially giving a lot of people about to leave and join the job market one-to-one interviews to try and focus their job search. The authorities in Henan and across the rest of China as well are targeting state-run businesses, civil service groups, and even the military to try and recruit more graduates, to try and soak up these nearly 12 million graduates who are going to be joining the job market, or hopefully join the job market this year. And Xi Jinping himself, China's leader, has said something as well. In a front page editorial a few weeks ago, he said that young people had to perhaps set their sights a little lower. He used a phrase which is really common in China, eating bitterness, to really just accept something below their expectations. But a lot of graduates aren't willing to do that.
Michael Bristow. Still to come in this podcast.
Whether or not they publish it or take it down, you can't afford to lose this material.
How to preserve evidence of war crimes on social media.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, and offer only available until July 15th.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back. In the latest sign of progress on reproductive rights in Argentina, women will no longer need a prescription to get the morning after pill. The emergency contraception can help prevent unwanted pregnancy if taken shortly after unprotected sex. It comes 3 years after the Catholic majority country approved laws to allow abortions up to the 14th week of pregnancy. Our Latin America editor is Phoebe Hobson.
Now you can buy the morning after pill over the counter in Argentina. Beforehand, you would need a doctor's prescription before you had access to it. And the health ministry have said, you know, this is to improve access to the emergency contraception. It's to help in situations where other forms of contraception aren't available. So that could be condoms or, you know, the pill or other means of contraception. And also potentially in areas where, you know, education around sex isn't that good and women need to have access to this sort of last stop before an unwanted pregnancy. It's been welcomed by feminist groups who say that it's going to help destigmatize access to the morning after pill. So, you know, while it's been this green tide, as it's known, of sort of a broadening of reproductive rights in Argentina, the Catholic Church still has a lot of sway. And going to a doctor and asking for a prescription, you know, there might be issues of judgment. People might feel ashamed about accessing the emergency contraception. Obviously, pro-life groups, as they're known as, see it as sort of promoting abortive measures. Of course, the emergency contraception isn't an abortion, but they see it as not taking seriously the abstinence, which would be what the Catholic Church would prefer.
Phoebe Hobson. Human rights groups are warning that social media companies are deleting evidence of possible war crimes from their platforms. Campaigners say vast amounts of videos and photos that could be of use to prosecutors are being deleted because they break rules on graphic content. And they're calling on social media companies to do more to preserve this sort of material. Jack Goodman from the BBC's Global Disinformation Team reports.
On the 28th of December 2013, Imad was working in his pharmacy in the Syrian city of Aleppo when a barrel bomb was dropped onto a crowded food market nearby.
First of all, you see something in front of you that you are unable to process. But what brought me back to reality were the corpses. A hand, a leg, bodily remains, burnt corpses.
Imad's friends and customers were among the dozens of people killed in the attack by the Syrian government.
The regime would justify every strike by saying they were targeting terrorists, but most of the victims were children, women and civilians shopping in a vegetable market.
Imad remembers a local TV company filming the attack and had seen the footage online. Years later, when he applied for asylum in the European Union, he looked for it again.
I was asked to provide documents that proved my identity and that I was there. I was sure that my pharmacy was captured on camera. But when I went on Twitter, it was taking me to a deleted video.
The harrowing video had been removed by social media platforms. And in the chaos of a country at war, the original footage was also missing. It appeared the images that might one day be used as evidence to prosecute those responsible were lost for good. Incidents like this aren't a one-off. So why is this happening? Social media companies have long been criticised for allowing easy access to distressing content. Relatives of those killed in horrific events have been traumatised when images of their dead loved ones are posted online. Now, platforms are increasingly cracking down swiftly to delete content like this. Most of it is taken down by artificial intelligence. It automatically finds things like violence, pornography or child abuse. That's also sweeping up evidence of war crimes and human rights abuses, often filmed on smartphones, material that might one day be invaluable for investigators. Mnemonic is a human rights group based in Berlin. Mnemonic has saved well over 700,000 images before they were removed from social media, including three videos of the attack on the market witnessed by Imad. That's why the footage you heard earlier has survived. But organisations with limited resources can't capture everything, which is why Belkis Villa from Human Rights Watch says an independent body should be established to preserve this material.
We're asking the social media companies to allow for a system that international investigators could use to get access to content that's been taken down to investigate potential war crimes.
We asked YouTuber Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, about this idea. In a statement, Meta told us they respond to valid legal requests from law enforcement agencies, and they continue to explore additional avenues to support international accountability processes consistent with their legal and privacy obligations. And YouTube said,
"We have specific exemptions for graphic content in the public interest. But YouTube is not an archive, and those documenting human rights abuses should observe best practices for securing and preserving their content."
That isn't good enough for Alan Rusbridger, former editor of the British newspaper The Guardian, who now sits on the oversight board that advises Meta.
The social media companies are being overcautious. They've copped a lot of criticism over the years for leaving graphic and violent stuff up. Whether or not they publish it or take it down, you can't afford to lose this material.
Imad now lives in France. We've hidden his identity to protect his family back home. He hopes that one day the footage of the market attack will help bring the perpetrators to justice.
These videos are very important for me. My kids must know what happened. I have a story to tell, and this story must be truthful.
Jack Goodman. Could fish made in a lab be the seafood of the future? A company in Israel has come up with a way to create fish meat using stem cells and then putting them into a special 3D printer which turns out fish fillets. Artificially grown meat and fish are ways of reducing the impact of mass farming on the environment. But is it really something that whets your appetite? Well, Eric Kaufman, the CEO of the company behind the concept, Stakeholder Foods, told us more.
The 3D printers that we've developed, they produce real meat, either cattle or fish, with almost zero emissions extracted to the air. We don't harm the animals in the process. And we believe that that's the future of food consumption. I think that compared to what we are used to today, products that try to mimic meat that are plant-based, we are doing the real deal. We are collecting real cells. We proliferate them. And the end result is a product that is, at this point, almost exactly the same as the fish that you are used to eat in the restaurant. We have a few cell lines, and we know how to grow the cell lines. And through our printers, we mix it with very advanced bioink that are printed like very precisely, and it allows and enables the fibers to grow and to mimic exactly the same texture and taste as the real fish. The products that we print right now are ready-to-cook products, meaning that the moment they are printed, we can cook and then consume them. And the magic that the printer enables is mimicking the texture and the flakiness of the fish. That's something that one can do only with very advanced hardware. We're printing on nothing. So the bioinks themselves, they form the fish fillet. We don't need a scaffold. Bioink itself enables the texture. It tastes amazing. So I think that the fish that we've 3D printed right now, it's not the first cultivated product that we've printed, but I can say that as one that has tasted many cultivated products, this by far was our most advanced product, and it tasted amazing.
Eric Kaufman. After smash hit runs in the UK, the US and elsewhere, the TV series The Office is arriving in Australia in a new adaptation. The mockumentary-style programme started here in the UK and starred Ricky Gervais as boss David Brent.
And I get all this, "Oh, David, you know, you're a brilliant singer-songwriter. You're stuck in Slough. Well, it's Texas that are off, you know, making all the money. You know, and they're rubbish compared to you." And I go, "Don't slag them off." I say, "I've been there. I've done that. You know, that's behind me. You know, and I, you know, I respect..." Thing is, we're both good in our own fields. I'm sure Texas couldn't run and manage a successful paper merchants. Yeah, I couldn't, you know, do what... Actually, I could do what they do. And I think they knew that even back then. Probably what spurred them on.
Ricky Gervais as David Brent. Well, the popular American series began in 2005 and included Hollywood actor Steve Carell as Michael Scott, the American version of David Brent.
"I've been at Dunder Mifflin for 12 years, the last four as regional manager. When I come through here, see, we have the entire floor. So this is my kingdom, far as the eye can see. Ah, this is our receptionist, Pam. Pam! 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 Pam Beasley. Pam has been with us for forever. Right, Pam?
Well, I don't know.
If you think she's cute now, you should have seen her a couple of years ago.
What?
And there are 10 others. The Office Australia will be the 13th adaptation and the first to have a female boss. The Australian comedian and actor Felicity Ward will be starring in the hapless middle manager role. Michelle Hussain spoke to Ash Atala, who's one of the producers behind the original UK Office. He explained what it was like to see the programme being adapted.
The American one at the time we were really cautious of because I think there was so much love for the UK version, and I think we were worried that it was going to spoil the work that we had done and the love in which it was held. We got lucky with the casting of Steve Carell because his movie career, he was just about to do The 40-Year-Old Virgin and his movie career exploded. And in terms of having a hit comedy, lightning sort of struck twice on both sides of the Atlantic for The Office.
It's interesting that it's taken this long for there to be a female boss from hell featuring in any of these adaptations.
Yeah, I agree. And not just that, they are clearly talking about a post-COVID office environment. And so when I heard about it, I thought, wow, people are still coming to that material. But actually, this is a proper freshen up, I think.
It's interesting that The Office did get remade so many times, whereas there are lots of other sort of classic comedy genres that haven't.
Yeah, what it always had was universal themes. And I think, you know, we've just been discussing office politics changing a lot. I also think there's a lot of office DNA that is exactly the same. And the rather melancholy themes of how people work today are a sense of, you know, disassociation from what you do. I think if you ask people, most people don't enjoy what they do. It's not what they grew up dreaming of doing. You live for the weekend and the money is for your mortgage. And I think those rather depressing thoughts, not ones that you would have, Michelle, in your job, but I think that a lot of people would suffer, I'm afraid, would be the same, actually. And so everything's changed in the office, and yet I suspect much remains very much the same.
Ash Atala speaking there to Michelle Hussain. And finally, last year, NASA set up a panel to investigate reported sightings of unidentified flying objects, UFOs. And on Wednesday, it held its first public meeting live on TV. Researchers say they're examining about 800 mysterious cases of what they call unidentified anomalous phenomena, or UAPs. So, are we surrounded by extraterrestrial spacecraft just waiting to be discovered? Paddy McGuire explores the findings.
According to the scientists, there are between 50 and 100 new UAP sightings each month. So what not on Earth are they? NASA has spent decades debunking such sightings, and its resistance to being transparent has fueled conspiracy theories. Just what is it that NASA is hiding? By appearing live on TV, the 16-strong panel of experts are making a significant change of direction. They said eyewitness reports and current data are insufficient for conclusive evidence of extraterrestrial activity, but that the vast majority of cases display mundane characteristics. They are not UFOs. In one case, an optical illusion made a pilot think he had seen a UFO, but it turned out to be a balloon of Bart Simpson. As another example, they presented a video taken by a naval aircraft over the western US that showed a series of dots moving across the night sky. The military plane, a P-3, was unable to intercept the object, as Sean Kirkpatrick, one of the panelists, explained.
The reason they couldn't catch them is because after further analysis, it was shown that those objects were actually much farther away from the P-3 than they thought. And in fact, when we went even deeper, looked at air traffic control data, we were able to match those to aircraft on a major flight corridor heading into a major airport for landing.
It's precisely these kinds of incidents that can cause highly trained pilots and sensors to be baffled by what they see. Data aside, historical stigma around UFOs has also hampered research. Commercial pilots, for example, are sometimes reluctant to report sightings that can't be explained. And the panel members themselves have been getting online abuse since they started their work, another factor which can discourage openness in the field, according to NASA science chief Nicola Fox.
Harassment only leads to further stigmatization of the UAP field, significantly hindering the scientific progress and discouraging others to study this important subject matter.
So how many of these hundreds of sightings are truly unexplained? About 2 to 5%, say the experts. And while the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life has not been ruled out, no sighting has yet provided proof of anything of alien origin. The panel is hoping to issue its full report in July.
Paddy Maguire. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Gareth Jones. The producer was Iona Hampson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, and offer only available until July 15th.